Hello and welcome to episode 8 of Tabletop Game Talk, a show where we talk about tabletop games of all types. I'm one of your hosts, Josh.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Kitty.
Today we'll be talking about social games, what makes one game more social than another. Are all games social to some extent? We'll find out. But first, let's go off topic for some news, announcements, and feedback.
Yeah, so our biggest announcement for the day is we have a special guest host, Spencer.
Ooh. Yay, my husband's here.
Nice.
That's me. I should probably start talking.
Yeah, that's why we're all looking at you. Yeah. Like, what are you
doing?
Nice
to have you, Spencer.
Waving doesn't work. It is
nice to be had.
Yes. So, Spencer is an avid listener. He's listened to like a half of an episode.
Yeah. I think I may have finished one.
All right.
Wow. Wow. That's
He's
impressive.
Really supportive.
I'm dedicated. So, yeah. I'm a good friend.
He knows nothing about all the things we've said about him. So yeah. We have to.
Unless he listened to that particular podcast where we talked about him a lot.
I wouldn't
be here now.
You just ask Kitty, which is the one I'm in the most?
Yes. None of them.
Yeah. So to stick with the theme of significant others being part of the show, we got an email. Ooh. An actual email to tabletopgametalk@gmail.com. It's from someone named Sydney.
Oh,
we've never heard of that person.
No, never heard of that person. But she has a great question, so I figured we should start off with some questions. What are your experiences with and opinions on games that have the best opening moves? Or games deciding opening moves, like game deciding opening moves. If you don't do this, you're going to lose.
Right.
Does that vary with a number of players? Do you think most games have them? Do you ever try to buck the norm and do something crazy on move one?
So I'm going to jump in here. Uh-huh. That's awful.
Why?
I hate that.
All right.
Well, when games do actually have an opening deciding move.
That's that decisive? Sure.
Yeah.
I'm going to...
Not that it's... If you have the option, right? Yeah. If there's a gambit that you could play on the opening move, like it's a huge gamble and maybe it pays off, that's fine.
Right.
But if the consequences of any decision you make are always that drastic... That's awful.
Well, I would say that game that we the game of Risk we played at the
that's
beginning.
That's exactly what
right?
I was going to say. Risk.
Yeah.
If you are playing a game of Risk where you are picking the countries, whoever gets to choose first has a huge advantage.
Yeah.
And there's like a couple different spots that you can pick on the map. And I know you like Risk, so.
Yeah,
this should be relevant to you.
So you're right that I like Risk, but you're wrong about everything else that you said. there's a bit of an advantage when you get to pick countries first, but it's not that big of an advantage.
Really?
Oh, no, no,
absolutely.
No.
Yeah, because we played Risk Legacy. I mean, I don't know if it was the Legacy game, but it was the standard map, right?
It is the standard map, and it is the same opening moves. The difference is the end condition of the game.
Right.
It's not an elimination style game in Risk Legacy.
Well, I think there's a couple others you can look at too. Like Settlers of Catan is very much if you put your cities in the wrong spot at the beginning,
right,
you're going to be disadvantaged for the entire game.
But I don't think it's a game ruiner.
I actually think that's a great comparison because I think that the impact is about the same between the way you do your initial startup and Risk and the fact that it's very turn-based. You take one at a time, people are picking.
I think that in both those cases, though, it's dependent on very much so the number of players. Mm-hmm. If you're playing a 6-person game of Risk, no one can really get a foothold in a continent that fast. When we were playing the 3-person game, Josh took South America, Chris took Australia, and I was like, well, that's it.
Well,
I'm done.
And that's where, and this is going to dovetail nicely into today's topic, that's where the social aspect comes in. Right?
Well,
because the two of them now they have an establishment, but you get to play spoiler. You get to play spoiler.
Yeah.
And if you're smart about it, you can work them against each other or make it an alliance that allows you to gain the upper hand and overthrow one of them.
And that's what I had to try and do in our game of Risk when we played our first round. I did what Sydney talked about, like doing some crazy move one. I was like, I'm gonna go in Europe. And hadn't played Risk in a few years and realized how terrible that was.
Yeah.
And made some bad...
Europe is an awful place.
Yeah, and I just got
second only to Asia
very quickly. But I wasn't eliminated, so I could be that spoiler. And I just started to concentrate in one area. And I was just like, oh, I'm going to take one of these guys down.
Yeah.
He had like 40 troops in Sweden.
Yeah, it worked out well until you moved them out and I just came in and took over your home base. But...
yeah, I didn't see that. Never mind.
That is the tricky part of Legacy.
Yeah. Well, I think...
it's not as visible.
I honestly think that Risk you can kind of recover from, because Risk you can move around the map. You can move your entire troops
to other locations. You can take a risk.
You can take a risk. You can. I can take over Australia if I want to. If I want to make that push.
Yeah.
Catan, though, if you put your two starting settlements in two bad areas on the board, there is really no coming back from that. Another game that has that problem is Terra Mystica. A very good game, very asymmetrical, lots of different. Every player's race is different, but mm-hmm. if you don't know how that race plays, you can just screw yourself over in the first turn,
right.
especially because that is also a turn-limited game. I believe there's only 7 rounds total. So if your first 1 or 2 rounds are playing catch-up because you didn't make the exact right move,
right.
you're not going to have fun in rounds mm-hmm. 5, 6, 7.
Terra Mystica, is that one of those awful games that you made me play?
Yeah,
it's one of the ones. That's the terraforming one that you... Like, we forced you to play.
Wait, what falls under the category of terrible games you make me play? Like, what constitutes a game like that?
Well, if Chris made me play it and it was an awful experience, then that falls into that group.
Okay.
And I think with Terra Mystica, the problem that I had here was that it was so incredibly complicated, not even just from a gameplay perspective, but even just visually. There's so much going on, you can't follow it all.
I think it's visually appealing. It's a very pretty game. Mm,
well, you're wrong. I've not seen
it. It is a bit busy, but yeah. it's nice busy. It looks nice, but it can be hard to follow. It takes a little bit to get into.
Right.
Yeah. We should make this question an entire podcast.
I know.
But not today. Today right. we're going to move on.
We're moving on.
To our next... segment, new games I own / ordered / kickstarted. I didn't order anything new this week.
What? Are you feeling all right?
I did actually go to the game store and buy a new game. I bought Codename Pictures.
All right, so you lied.
I don't know if it's really ordering. Right? I just happened to be there. Also, Terraforming Mars came in. Cry Havoc came in. Seafall came in.
Wow.
I need more evenings free, and we'll have to play all of those things. Terraforming Mars looks really cool. As far as gameplay is concerned, the quality of the components isn't quite where I expected it to be.
Right.
But looking at the gameplay, I can see there's a lot of fun that could be there. I also think that this game will be played in science classes around the world.
Yeah.
It seems like diplomacy, I played it in government class. Terraforming Mars, you're going to play it at some point in your science classes.
So you played games in class, huh?
I did play games in class.
That explains a lot.
Yeah. He was big on the games in class. It's just followed through into adulthood.
Yep.
Who would have thought?
Yeah. So games I have kickstarted. So 3 new games. Actually, no, 2 new games. They're kind of the same game, though. The first one is Star Saga, which is a space dungeon crawly game. It looks kind of cool. Lots of grids and lots of space marines and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I like dungeon crawl games. I should stop doing this. I should stop saying things and not defining the word. So a dungeon mm-hmm. crawl game
right.
is a game essentially where there is a grid map that gets laid out. You're moving your characters through and you're killing monsters as you move through. And there's usually some kind of goal you're trying to get to. So you're moving across the board, fighting things off until you succeed.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that one looked really nice. It was on the front page of Kickstarter, said recommended for you. And I'm like, well, since you recommended it.
That marketing department were really doing their thing on
so well.
They really do. It's like, they'll just throw anything on there. Another one was Siege of the Citadel. And this one, they call themselves a techno fantasy game.
I have no idea what that is, but sounds cool.
It's fantasy, but there's some techno mixed into it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like,
a little exactly bit. Exactly the words that are in the descriptor. Yeah.
So apparently this is a reboot. This is a game that came out in 1990-ish. And they redid it, new components. There's 2 expansions that come along with it. So for $120, you get to back everything.
Wow.
So you have the base game and 2 expansions and all the Kickstarter things. So right now, and this kind of scares me, they say the Kickstarter is over. It just ended yesterday. The value of the Kickstarter is $490 or something like that.
But you only paid $120 or something.
We only paid $120. So that $120 is going to get us all of these components. Oh. But when that happens, it's like suddenly, how are you making money on this?
Yeah.
Because I'm only paying you $120. You're saying it's a $600 practical value.
Right.
how are you going to send this to me? So I'm a little concerned about this one, to be honest. Right. We'll see. We'll see if the risk pays off.
Let's hope it turns up.
Yes. So we'll see. And finally, we're going to talk about the game of today, which today we played Tiny Epic Galaxies in honor of the fact that I kickstarted the expansion to Tiny Epic Galaxies. I mentioned that last week. So let's get into the game of today. So yeah, Tiny Epic Galaxies is part of the Tiny Epic line of games, all by the same designer. Yeah, that's all it is. They're small box games, but they actually really do have a big game feel to them, even though it's usually just a few cards, in this case, dice. And the first one I played was Tiny Epic Kingdoms. It's an area control game. This one is kind of a 4X space exploration research type of game. The next one he did was Defenders, Tiny Epic Defenders, which is a co-op game where you're fighting against the board. There's Tiny Epic Western coming out. I've currently pre-ordered that before we did the podcast, so I'm not lying about it. This was a Gen Con. So we'll see when that comes in, how that works out. But Tiny Epic Galaxies is each of you take on like a civilization, and you have four spaceships. You start out with only two. It's a dice rolling game. The dice allow you to choose your actions. So there's six different actions, that, you know, whether how to get resources, how to move around, you know, basically conquering planets and things like that. And you play until somebody gets 21 points. So you get points by going up to increasing your colony civilization, tech level. And you also get points for taking over planets. So we played this, it was actually a very exciting game. I think Kitty and I took an early lead.
Mm-hmm.
And then Josh
masterfully came back from nowhere to win the game.
I feel like this happened last week too, like always.
Well,
now.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, it did come down to a tie.
It did. And I didn't know the tiebreaker conditions until we were already tied.
Yeah.
Not seems that unfair, Chris. Back to teaching games.
Would have mattered at all, but sure, fine. I guess when you're talking about 21 points, you should talk about a tiebreaker.
Also, I didn't think that Josh was going to complete his secret mission, since at like the second to last turn, he went, "Oh yeah, I have a secret mission." I was really not counting on him getting those 2 points. Or maybe I wouldn't have ended the game.
Maybe that was part of my secret plan to throw you off.
It was a secret.
Yeah.
It was a secret to everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And since there was a little bit of randomness in the die roll, he had to get lucky on the last turn extra 2 points. But yeah, I thought it was, I really like the Tiny Epic games. They're relatively short. I think you guys learned it and played it in under an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now you could play it in even less than that.
Yeah.
So.
No, it was great. It was fast paced. Everyone was involved in each of the moves. Like,
yeah.
You could follow other people's moves while they were taking theirs. And you just always felt like you were doing something.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Spencer was watching us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not paying attention.
And I was there too.
You could almost hear that.
Seemed like you were kind of having fun.
Yeah. My favorite part of the game,
good endorsement,
though, was when Spencer found out that the beer he was drinking was non-alcoholic.
That was, by the way, no. We need to devote a little more time to this. Because like any red-blooded, self-respecting American male, I come into your home and I don't say anything. I just go to your fridge and I take your beer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I don't know if I've ever been more shocked and disappointed in my life than to realize that it was a non-alcoholic beer. What kind of a man keeps a non-alcoholic beer in his fridge?
Wait, how did Josh describe the non-alcoholic beer again?
I think it was something along the lines of, oh, it's like beer, but without the, ooh.
Exactly.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
It's been in the refrigerator for a while. The last party we had, which was a few months ago, and we have these all building parties, so Spencer, Kitty, and I all live in the same building. But I figured I don't want to drink excessively at this party. I want to not pass out by 11 o'clock, which is what happened the party
that
before.
That is not how I recall this going down.
Just saying, I had some on hand, and there was, I still ended up passing out at some point in that night.
Well, anyways, it was still a non-alcoholic beer, so I felt even though it was a non-alcoholic beer, it's still a beer technically, I guess. And I felt like I had to finish it. So I finished it, and now I'm having another regular beer to reward myself for finishing the number.
That's good for you. Very good thing. You deserve it, man.
So, I do deserve it. Yeah. I think I deserve a couple.
All right. Well, let's get on topic here. This seems like a good segue to actually talking about the topic. So
we have a designated topic?
A designated
we
topic.
We do. You really haven't listened to our show.
Now you have to be quiet for the on-topic
Oh, I've listened
segue.
To the show.
Oh boy. All right, here goes. One moment.
In this episode, we're talking about social games. What is a social game? Aren't all games social in some way? What are our favorite social games? Let's find out.
Yeah, so I figured social games is one of the tricky things. It's like, oh, what? It's a game. Of course you're being social.
Right.
But I would personally define a social game as something that encourages conversation between people.
Yes.
In such a way that you can get to know them or actually build relationships with them while playing.
Ooh, that's a high bar for it to be a social game, I feel.
Yes.
I will say I think that is a legitimate definition. You know, you could argue for that being one, but it's not a layup. Because not all games involve any kind of socializing at all. Like, take solitaire.
Well, yeah, that's
a game.
That's what I'm saying.
Right. Our topic is just what games are social.
Or considered social
but
games.
My point is what I'm bringing up here is between the definition that you just laid out and solitaire, there's a middle ground there.
Yes, that's right.
And that's where we will be treading today.
Even the game we just played. So we were talking about Tiny Epic Galaxies, where on everyone's turn, you can react to what they're doing.
Yes.
And so you were paying attention. Everyone was involved in the situation.
Yep.
But we were not conversing with each other.
No.
Not a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. We weren't trying to get to know each other. We weren't saying, so Josh, what are you going to do this next weekend or anything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Like, that was not part of the game. We also weren't having conversations with each other.
Yeah.
Short of a little bit of taunting here. And there's like, are you sure you want to do that? I kind of want to do that. Let's see how that works.
Or why did you do that?
Exactly. And when you think, well, when I think social games, I also think social deduction games.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kitty loves to have an opinion on social deduction games. Kitty, what do you think is the difference between a social game and a social deduction game?
A social game is a game where you are building relationships. A social deduction game is a game where you're calling people liars to their faces.
Well, I do that all the time. I think that a social deduction game is a subset of a social game.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I would say that all social games are almost exclusively enjoyed by sociopaths.
Okay.
Well, really, think about it. All social games are centered around, to a varying degree, depending how you want to draw the line, it's gamifying the manipulation of people.
Yeah.
It's like CEOs and politicians. I mean, who is drawn to this kind of thing? Yeah. Chris?
I will give that to you for social deduction games, not for all social games, though.
So,
yeah.
All right. First of all, to say that you can't build a relationship in a social deduction game, I've met some of my best friends at conventions playing Are You a Werewolf?
Right.
Which is a game exactly like Katie described, sitting around calling each other's liars.
Yep.
And they are also all bad people, just like
you. They're all werewolves.
Stop alienating our fans, Spencer.
They relish it. They know what they are.
We promise to never have him back again. But no, and it's not like I'm the werewolf, Josh is not the werewolf. We're not going to form a bond in that game. That's not going to happen. But if I'm sitting next to someone and the two of us are talking, trying to find out the werewolf, and both of us were on Team Good, and we find the werewolves and we win the game, that creates a bond that lasts for a really, really long time.
Which is where I was going to jump in, is that I think that any game where you are on a team is a good social, like it is a team building activity. You build more relationships when you have someone on your side as opposed to games like I Feel Like Werewolf, you don't know that somebody is on your side because if you are sitting next to someone and you think you're both on Team Good and me and Chris are sitting there plotting who it is and we accuse someone and then all of a sudden Chris is the werewolf and killed me, like that's it. I'm done with Chris forever. He's betrayed me.
That's true. It can like, form bonds, but it can also put walls up between people that will never come down.
Not that I'm still
maybe
mad
if they take it too seriously, maybe. But I don't know.
Have you met
Kitty?
I have had a few people I've played Werewolf with where I'm like, I will never play another game with that person again.
Yeah, but
because of the way they
played?
They weren't even the well. One of them, he was the wolf, but oftentimes they don't even have to be the opposite side.
Right.
It's just the way they approach that game, where they let the anger kind of fester,
right?
And then they take it, make it on a personal level,
right?
It's like, all right, that's not the kind of person I really enjoy being around.
Right, you have to have that psychopathic ability to just separate what you're doing to all these people from any actual emotional investment. If you can't do that, you shouldn't be playing.
That is true. Well, let's go to, so that's Are You a Werewolf?
I'm really convincing myself of this. I mean, I started with this argument just to annoy you, but I'm really starting to play.
Yeah. It's true, it's well, true.
I'm going to switch to a game that is a little bit more accurate. Well, It kind of will emphasize Spencer's satirical point just a touch. So Werewolf is a game, just real briefly again, we have to stop using words that people may not understand. 15 people typically, 2 people are werewolves, 1 person has a special power. Those 2 werewolves are trying to eat people in the night. The night is everyone just has their eyes closed except for the werewolves. During the daytime, the entire group has to come together to decide who to lynch because they think they're a werewolf. And if you lynch the werewolves before the werewolves eat the village, you win. Switch over to the Resistance or Avalon. They're kind of the same game. Avalon just has a couple mm-hmm. additional rules.
Are all based on Mafia, which I think is the game that most people would be familiar with. It's just with a deck of cards playing, you know, somebody explains the rules to you. None of these fancy boxes or anything.
Right. So Werewolf is based very much completely on Mafia. Mm-hmm. Resistance was built in a way because Werewolf is elimination. So if you have mm-hmm. a group of 15 people and you get eliminated, then you're just watching the game for however long it takes.
Mm-hmm. Which happens a lot to dudes with beards.
Yes.
Everyone thinks you're a werewolf.
Look werewolfy.
Or if you're wearing a red shirt, then you have to be the first person out. All these rules. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the Resistance is up to 10 players. And this game is non-elimination. In this game, half the group are good guys and half the group are bad guys, Team Blue and Team Red. It's the Resistance and Spies. The Spies are bad, the Resistance are good, so it's mm-hmm. kind of confusing that way. Team Blue, Team Red. Blue is good, Red is bad. There are less Team Red than Team Blue, but Team Red knows who everyone else is. So everyone closes their eyes, Team Red opens their eyes, sees who they are, and then everyone closes their eyes and you wake up. And the game progresses from there. The way that game works is every round you get to send a certain number of people on a mission. And that will depend on how many people are playing in mm-hmm. the game. So the first mission is usually 2 or 3 people. If you go on a mission and there's a voting round after the leader says, I think these 2 people should go on a mission. Mm-hmm. There's a vote whether or not people think yes, it's a good team or not. Everyone gets to see how people voted to say yes or no. If it passes, those 2 people will go on a mission. They have 2 cards in front of them, one that says pass and one that says fail. If you're on Team Blue, you're only allowed to play the pass card. You can't fail that mission. Mm-hmm. If you're on Team Red, you can decide one or the other.
Mm.
So it's like, oh, I'm going to fail this. A single failure fails the mission.
Right.
So if a spy's on the mission, you want to fail it, then it's failed. Now, those mm-hmm. 2 people, if someone fails it, now everyone knows one of those 2 people must be the spy.
Yeah.
But that's only the first round. The next round, you go to 3, then 4,
you
then 5.
More and more people.
More and more people, and it can potentially fail more and more. With the more people, if you have, I think once you hit 6 players, you have 3 people that go on the first mission. But essentially, mm-hmm. the concept's the same. This game has everyone accusing everyone else of being spies.
Yeah.
I do like it better, though, because I'm not sure. It might just be the group that I played with. I've only played it one time, so we played it with our regular gaming group instead of playing Pathfinder one day. Yeah. We didn't have enough time. We sat down and played Resistance a couple times.
Yep.
So I knew everybody, and I think it's a little bit easier when you already have relationships with people to play these games.
You feel more comfortable calling people out and...
Oh, yeah.
It's easier to read them, too.
Yes.
Right. You already know the type of person everyone is.
And the other thing it introduces is Werewolf, I would say, is almost a pure social game. There are no mechanics to that game, sort of, mm-hmm. you know, how someone gets voted out. Uh-huh. This one has a lot of mechanics that you can watch. Yeah. You can see how people vote. You can see how leaders, which passes every round, how they're setting out the teams, and you can deduce by what people are doing via the game mechanics whether or not they might be good or bad.
Even if everyone is just, like, completely silent, you don't do any, like, real social gameplay, you can still kind of play the game and just, you know, figure it out from what who's doing what.
Their behavior, yeah.
So. And, yeah, a powerful speaker is going to be able to sway people one way or the other. But you don't have to be that domineering personality to have fun playing the game.
Well, I think even in, like you say, it's different because that's less of an issue in Resistance as it is in Werewolf. In Werewolf, you have no information, really, other than people's reactions to go off. In this game, like we're saying, you have that behavior. And so even with that powerful personality persuading people, you can go back and go, hang on a second, but logically, this person voted like that. That person voted like this. Doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Well, I actually use this game for one of my work events. So we did an offsite kind of training event, per se, for some of the developers I work with. And we use this as kind of an icebreaker thing, where everyone got around and we're playing social deduction games. We're playing the Resistance. And I did not play for the first several rounds. I just like, okay, this is how you play. Because I wanted to see how they would start accusing each other.
Right.
And it's fun to watch people. The first couple of games you play here, you don't really have a much of an idea of what's going on or how it works. And then all of a sudden, people catch on saying, oh, if I'm a spy, I have to lie, or I have to pretend I have to be this. Or, oh, I know what I'm looking for now if somebody's acting this way.
Yeah. Once you see, because I think a couple times, like, if you're the spy the first time, it's a little bit tough. Like, if you've never seen someone play the spy, or at least play the spy well. I think it was Jessica is very good at being on the spy team, and watching her play can help you learn how to play the spy team.
Yeah.
That's cool. And it's an interesting dynamic to have people at, you know, the point of the game is to lie. And so if you don't know these people, like we were talking about before, what are we getting out of these social games? It's interesting to immediately see people you don't even know lying and how good they are at it and the way they go about it. And you can learn things about each other that way.
Yeah. Well, and there's classes of this, of lying as well. Right. When I have 10 new people playing this game that aren't used to lying to each other, that's entertaining for everyone. Because everyone's like, no, I think you're definitely a spy. It's like, I'm not a spy. And you just, you know, the biggest grin on their faces and stuff. And then watching them get good. It's a problem when you have like a couple new players and some like really hardcore players.
Were you just saying that you taught your coworkers how to lie to each other better?
Well, he has to figure out who he can put in front of the client.
Yeah. Right? I need to know who is ready to like get out of the cubicle. We don't actually have cubicles, but equivalent.
The metaphorical cubicle.
The metaphorical cubicle.
As like tons of his employees like listening to the show now taking notes. Oh my goodness, yes.
Yeah. Well, when I finally did play at the end, they just assumed I was the spy.
Right.
Like, okay, you're
that's know kind this, of your role.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know this game too well. You're definitely a threat.
Even if you're not the spy, we just need to take you
now,
out.
Now why is it that everyone instinctually doesn't trust you?
This is turning into a therapy session.
I don't know, but it hurts. It's a sad thing. I mean, granted, I was the spy both times, and I did win both times, but I don't think that
But I don't know why they
don't know why they would have thought that. It's just, I don't know. So segue into, and we're slowly moving away from social deduction to social, Deception, Murder in Hong Kong. This is not a game I think a lot of people have played. But
I really like it.
It's so good. It's so good. So this game is very, very simple. Every player gets in front of them.
Wait, hold on. Spencer, is this game very, very simple?
I would not say it's very, very simple. I would say it is simple.
All right.
It's a good acid test.
It is at least approachable.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Also, it's about getting away with murder. So this plays again into my sociopath-like social games.
Oh, we just keep proving his points. Eventually, we're just going to have to
It's easy
it.
When you're right.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, so the way this game plays, one person is the forensic investigator. Basically, that's just their special role. They are going to try to show all of the other players who the murderer is without talking. Mm-hmm. So the way the game basically is laid out is everyone sits around a table, and you get four cards in front of you of two different types. You have four possible murder weapons and four possible clues. Then every player is going to get a card that's going to say either they're just a normal investigator or they're the murderer. Now, the forensic investigator is going to have everybody close their eyes, and then they're going to have the murderer wake up, and they're going to point to two cards in front of them, one weapon and one clue, and then that person's going to close their eyes and everyone's going to wake up again. The forensic investigator from that point on cannot talk to any of the other players, even though they're on the side of the players. Instead, they have six clue cards in front of them. And they will, one at a time, each card has, I believe, six or seven different words on them. Mm-hmm. And they're going to place a little pawn next to the words on the cards, one word
adjective
per card, the adjectives, to try to get the rest of the table to figure out what murder weapon was used and what clue was used. Mm-hmm. Now, in my experience, this tends to focus the entire table on the cards and not on the players. Mm-hmm. Now remember, one player is a murderer, but there's not a lot of conversation saying, I think Spencer's the murderer.
There's a bit of conversation about Spencer's the murderer. Also,
there's always a conversation
about Spencer being the murderer. It's that bad, man.
But it's not the whole conversation. Right. A good murderer can, like, and I think that it's like the murderer versus the forensic investigator, really. Yes. It's like, and both the selections you make at the beginning, because you have to look at all of the cards on the board and see what kind of connections there are.
Yeah.
The first game we played, I think somebody thought they were making a, you know, like whatever kind of choice. But, one of the descriptions, one of the adjectives that was up there was artistic. And there was only like, it was a statue was the only art on the table, which was very much like just, oh, well, now we all figured that one out, kind of.
So now we know who the murderer is, because this is the only murder weapon that makes sense.
Yeah.
And the game progresses over three rounds, so you'll get to switch out, as a forensic investigator, you'll switch that out. Everyone only gets one guess, so if the murderer can get away, they don't have to not be discovered. So Spencer's the murderer.
Mm-hmm. As always.
He just needs to make sure that he's distracting enough that you don't choose the two cards that he picked.
Right.
You can get one of them. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And he's not going to point at his. He's not going, all right, I'm the murderer. I don't think it's this card. It must be that card there. Although that would be an interesting strategy. It's like, no, I'm the murderer. I picked those two cards. Go ahead, guess them.
Right.
What are you going to do? I'm telling you the cards. Are you going to guess it or not?
I'm going to win the next time we play against Chris.
Anti-strategy. I like it.
Pointing at the two legit cards?
Maybe.
Now, that's a gambit.
Yeah.
Right? It really is.
Yeah.
Talk about a bold opening move. Bring it full circle.
Yeah.
I'm seeing a thread here as we're talking about social games that I think plays into maybe one of the differences in the games that that Kitty likes and doesn't like. And if you're looking at Mafia, Resistance, and Murder in Hong Kong, there's a growth here in the number of channels that information is being delivered over.
Yes. Mm.
So in Mafia, it's, like you said, it's a pure social game. The only information you get is how you read other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Resistance, you're getting that little bit of this almost objective information, right, of how people are playing. But Murder in Hong Kong is taking it all these different directions, right, of what people are reading people, and what gets put on. And I really think that the forensic investigator, right, is another role, is a unique mechanic.
Yeah.
Where it's still person to person, it's social, but it's not, because you're only allowed to communicate through those mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. It's really fun to play that role.
Yeah. That's my favorite part,
And with that role, and talking about social games, that role is the least social of the group.
Yeah.
Because the rules.
Which might be why I like it.
The rules are, you can't talk. Right, you can only communicate,
but you're a catalyst
I don't know if I agree that it's the least social, because everyone is paying a lot of attention to what you're doing and reading your face all the time too. Right, it's not just what
I
you're
gave
doing,
it away one time
trying to not
because
do.
Spencer was the murderer, and he wasn't pointing accurately enough, and I was too familiar in my reprimand of him not pointing accurately, and it just totally gave it away.
Because everybody at the table was like, well, she'd only speak to Spencer.
Well, and that's an important thing. As the forensic investigator, or anything where you have information and you're playing co-op with the rest of the group, one of the things you have to do is be strict on yourself to follow the spirit of the game. Because it's easy enough to just, like, I'm the forensic investigator, I'm just going to stare at the person who's the murderer. But you don't want to do that because that takes away the fun for everybody.
It's like you also have to be very cognizant of, like, unintentional things. Because it's not like I was, like, doing it on purpose. No, I wasn't trying to give it away.
Right.
I just spoke to a person the way I'd always speak to that person. But, you know, I wasn't going to yell at Chris to point to the cars the same way I would talk to Spencer. I have a different relationship with them. But you have to be, like, careful, like, and that's also really, with your facial expressions too, like, you can't just sit at the table and go like every time and somebody gets close to the right answer.
So it reminded me of the mechanics here, but I would think if you're the forensic investigator and they guess the murderer, that's like you winning, right? That's what you're trying to get them to do.
No, they need to guess the two specific cards,
right? But you know.
Yes.
And you're trying to get everyone to guess.
Yes.
Right? So in a if you were just curious, all you're worried about was winning, then you would just give it away. Right?
Right. But if it's
you
against could, the rules.
But it's against the rules.
Right.
But I mean, it's kind of subjective. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
oh, you could try and break the rules.
Yeah, if you weren't worried about the spirit of the game, if you just cared about winning,
It'd
be really easy to cheat and win.
Well, because the forensic investigator knows the answer.
Right.
The part of the game is you are trying to get the other people to guess the answer within the confines of what you're allowed. And in this particular game, ideally what would happen is there'd just be a wall in front of you, and you would stick your hand through a chute and just touch on different words.
But that would make it so much more boring.
It would. So that's why we don't do it.
What's amazing about the role is the hardest part is not winning. The hardest part is following the spirit of the game.
That is true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But one of the things that came up for me was when you said about, you know, you've got to make sure that you don't give anything away, and you've got to be careful as well as the murderer to act in a certain way. You know, you want to manipulate people and move people towards certain cards, but you don't want to do it in such a strong way that gives away instantly, oh, you're trying to manipulate things too much. You're going for really out there card choices, just to divert away from your obvious card choices. And a lot of the thread throughout these games is being very good, like you said at the beginning, at being sort of manipulative, lying, but it's an emotional intelligence thing. It's like, I've got to be smart enough to be a good actor, essentially, and mimic those emotions of someone who is really playing the good guy.
Yeah. Yep. Well, and so this game, Deception, is very similar in nature to another game called Mysterium, which is a full co-op game, but has that same aspect where the person who's giving the clues can't talk. They're just handing out cards, and then people have to try to figure it out based on that. And in that, where that's a full co-op game, you're not playing against anybody, it's really up to the group to decide what was over the line as far as breaking the rules.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the whole point of having those rules there. Another game, Hanabi, is a co-op game. It's not social at all. You're not
Hanabi?
Actually Hanabi.
Hanabi?
Yeah. It's
Harambe?
It's a game where
my podcast.
It's a game where you shoot gorillas.
No, it's a game where you're trying to make a fireworks show. This game, each player has a hand of cards that face away from them. So everyone else can see what they have, but you can't. And you give information in a specific way. You can point and say this is a number, what number it is or what color it is. But you, again, following very specific rules. Now, all of these games that have this kind of honor system rule set, you can fudge this any way you want. It's just making this social agreement that, okay, this is how we're going to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the forensic investigator has to keep a straight face.
It reminds me a little bit of a game that you do really like, Spencer, Spades, where with Table Talk.
I do love Spades.
Very much so. And we've discussed it on
Card game, is it right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Have you never played?
No.
We'll fix that soon.
I like it.
I would say that card games are a really good game to talk about social games.
They are a great social game. But you do have to stay in the spirit where, like, with partner games, you cannot talk about what you have in your hand to your partner.
Right.
Yep.
And there's a lot of speculation about like secret codes and table talk and signals and
competitive space, competitive euchre you'll only know if you're in the Midwest, but those kind of competitive team card games, if you're in a tournament and that's strict, it's like there is no talk. Right. Because anything you say or do could be cheating.
Yeah. No winking in a special way, no tapping each other. No.
And I grew up playing spades. It was a game of choice in my family. And my grandfather and his best friend were legendary for their ability to cheat without anybody picking up how.
Wow. Yeah.
Everybody knew that they had some sort of system.
They were doing it, but you could never catch them.
There would probably be some mirroring of like words that they would know to look out for. And like, it could just be something random. Like, oh, what's your birthday again? October. October means something.
and that actually, I think you could probably do a whole podcast episode talking about when is it okay to cheat.
Yeah. and in what ways people cheat, in what kind of games.
Because there are some games where it's in the rules, right? And it's this kitschy thing of like, oh, it's okay if you get away with it. But even something like if you're playing cards with my grandfather, for example, and he cheated, there's no money on the line.
Yeah.
And everyone knows he kind of does it. Uh-huh. So if you catch him, it's great. It almost becomes part of the game.
It gets a better game.
Even though it was never really formally addressed.
Yeah.
So there's definitely some scenarios where that can happen.
And it happens in social games a lot, because even in Werewolf, you know, there's the whole thing where everyone goes to sleep at the nighttime. And to cover the fact that people are going to be waking up, the werewolves, and pointing out people, and they might make a noise with their kind of clothes or something if they move and move their arm. So everyone has to tap their leg.
Yep.
And you can really psych people out and decide, oh, I'm just going to not tap my leg. Like if you were getting bored of the game and you just kind of wanted yourself to be eliminated, I've done that before where I just stopped tapping my leg. And then I'm like, yeah, they're all going to think I'm the werewolf. And then we get booted out this boring game.
And in werewolf games that I moderate, I actually consider that a form of cheating.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So people should not tap with two hands, because if you're tapping with two hands and you have to point, you're going to go to one hand. So if you're tapping with two hands the entire time, then you're saying, oh, I was tapping with two hands the entire time. I couldn't have pointed, even though you were probably pointing with your head if you're the werewolf or something.
Right.
I don't think that's cheating. I think it's just smart.
It is cheating.
Bending the rules.
It's cheating by using a piece of the game that's not meant to be used as a way of trying to figure something out.
Mm-hmm.
It's why we, and this doesn't happen in every werewolf game, but for the games I play at conventions and stuff, it's why everyone taps their hand and taps their leg. So you have movement and noise so other people can freely point at the nighttime. Mm-hmm. Another thing that happens in Resistance, we don't have a moderator. You don't have someone telling you to go to sleep. So I'm usually moderating, and I'll do something along the lines like, okay, everyone close your head, close your eyes and bow your head. And then everyone's now pointing down. Their mouths are pointing down. If I talk down, because my head is, eyes are closed and head's down,
right,
I'll say, okay, and the bad guys open up your eyes and look at each other. That's when I raise my head and look around. I don't talk again until my head is facing back down again.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And I've actually, in this work game, someone mentions like, well, I don't think Chris can be the spy because when he was talking, his voice was face down the entire time. And they were trying to use that as a way of figuring out who was up at night. That's not really what the game is. And that's why I think the more you can take away the meta knowledge at night, the better.
Yeah.
The more it makes the actual mechanics of the game more fun.
Yeah. You don't want to break it.
Right. So I'm going to switch to a game which I don't think any of you have played. And I haven't played in too long, but it's one that I'm desperate to get to the table.
Okay.
This sounds like it's going to be a great topic.
I just want to bring it out there because it is a really good example of a social game. And the game's existed for 30, 40 years now.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about now.
So the game's Cosmic Encounters. Oh. The current version is published by Fantasy Flight. And this particular game is all about making alliances with the people at the table. But the alliances change every single turn, and even sometimes within turns.
Whoa.
So the concept is a game. Everyone has five planets, and you have four ships on each of one of your planets. So you have 20 alien spaceships.
Mm-hmm.
And all you have to do to win the game is build colonies on four different planets that are not your own. And the way you do that is you choose a planet, and you say, I'm going to attack you. And then the person who owns that planet says, okay, I need some allies to come and help me defend. And the person attacking says, okay, I need allies to come help me attack.
Right.
If you're an attacker ally, you get a colony on the planet. That's what you want. Right. If you're a defender ally, you get bonus cards and things you can use later for attacking. This game is one of the most social games I think you can ever play because it's constantly shifting alliances. Okay, I was helping Josh out, but now he has too many colonies, so now we have to be against Josh.
Right.
And it's just always shifting what's going on.
It sounds like a game I would hate.
You would love it, and I say that just so you'll play it with me.
I know.
I mean, that doesn't sound... Maybe I'm just doing a bad job following your explanation there, but it doesn't sound like it's especially social in the aspects that you jump, I mean, more than any other competitive strategic game of when you draw up alliances.
I think it sounds like every single turn you're having to form an alliance. And so that requires you to speak to another person and say, hey, and try and convince them on each and every turn to help you do what you want.
Forcing your hand to competitively cooperate.
Right.
Yeah. Think, like, Risk, in a vocal way.
Yeah. Like Risk, you'll have temporary alliances.
You explain that so much better than Chris.
Thanks.
Yeah. And with a British accent.
Oh, yeah.
Well, with Risk, you can, like, have temporary alliances. With Cosmic Encounters, like I said, every single attack is going to recreate this discussion at the table.
Right.
Now, you're not really getting to know someone, like, on a personal level. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I'm Werewolf, I'll talk to someone. It's like, oh, so what do you do when you're not playing games? You're not doing that in Cosmic Encounter, but you are still constantly in conversations with all of them. So I think that... I got to get this to the table so you guys can stop looking at me with blanks.
I think we all went to sleep during that description.
I'm looking forward to it. It sounds cool.
I'm two beers in. Of course, one of them was non-alcoholic.
So general game, specific games aside, cooperative games. Are these social games?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But
that was easy.
Yeah, done.
Moving on.
But I mean, are they fun? Like, I haven't played them enough to know how fun they are as a social game. What would be your take on that?
We need to do more co-op games.
See, we do. Because I don't know that they're actually very good social games.
Right.
So we have a few that we have played. Kitty and I played Battle at Hogwarts, the Harry Potter deck building game. It's a co-op
game. I've played that as well, yeah.
We played Firefly, Legendary Encounters, which is a co-op game. We haven't played Pandemic yet, but we will get to that. And I kind of think that there's been a couple other ones. But in both of those deck building games, I don't know if there was a lot of conversation going on.
Hmm.
Or if it was just kind of like, okay, what's the best move we should make at this time?
Right. It's team strategizing, which you can say is socializing on some level because you're both coming to an agreement about what the strategy should be jointly, right?
I think part of being a team is having something to fight against. Mm. And when you're fighting against the board, it's flat. It doesn't really fight back.
And it's really depressing.
Right.
I mean, when you're fighting against another team, it's a human sort of conflict, right? Like a struggle. Right. It's fighting against the board. It's just like the machine.
Yeah.
Right. It's just like,
it doesn't feel as satisfying to you.
Yeah. It's this idea of like the world is out to get you and you're just barely trying to make it out.
Well,
and I guess sometimes that could be the right vibe. I know there's, what was the name of that game that, like zombie apocalypse survival game. You fight against the board. We've played together.
Dead of Winter?
I think that's
Dead of Winter, yeah.
The one where...
I actually think that, you know, that system fits very well for that that theme.
Well, but that one is a great... So that one's, you're not just fighting against the board. You might be fighting against one of your teammates as well.
Which was a very Secret frustrating.
Yeah.
It was a very frustrating experience for me learning that game because the only person who knew the game was the secret traitor.
Right.
Which is a bad situation. Yeah.
It was not.
And we will have an entire episode on secret traitor games because I love them. Straight co-op games to me, it's like sitting next to you and playing solitaire.
Yeah.
Like, we can do everything right. But if the cards just come up wrong,
the deck
lose.
Is stacked against you, it's not as
well. I have to be here when we talk about this because of all of the games you've made me play, most of which I did not like, I really loved Battlestar Galactica. That is such a good one. Exactly.
Is it a co-op game?
It is.
It's the Secret Traitor co-op game.
Yeah, it starts out as a pure co-op. You don't know who the Cylons are. You don't know anything. And then eventually...
Have you watched the show at all?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it follows that pattern where you don't know who the Cylons are, and then people will come out and be revealed as Cylons as the game progresses.
Isn't it even that like some of the people don't know that they're Cylons yet?
That's
like,
the twist. That's the M. Night Shyamalan approved twist.
Like halfway through, you have a second role card. You might get
dealt. You might have had it the whole time.
So halfway through, all of a sudden now your mission changes.
I'm not even a real human.
Right.
Exactly. Not a real boy. Yep.
And what I loved about that is I really like when the mechanics and the theme of something play into each other really well.
Yep.
And that really ties in perfectly with the show.
Yeah, I do definitely think that Hidden Traitor games make a great social game.
Yeah.
They are a category of their own for sure. Another category of their own, well, co-ops will be as well. We'll cover those a little bit deeper. But I wanted to throw this in here because we've joked about it a little bit, but I think they are the quintessential social game.
Yeah.
And that's drinking games.
Of course.
Right.
I hate drinking games.
Why?
Well, you also hate being social.
That's not true at all.
Depends on my mood. I drink because I am
an alcoholic.
chemically dependent is the way I would put it. Yes. It's a disease, Chris.
Understood.
It's a control thing. Like when I'm drinking, I'm controlling the level of intoxication I want to get. It's the same reason why I hate the guy who buys shots without asking anybody at the bar, and like all of a sudden it's like, now this is happening. No, man. Like I like to drink at my own pace.
Right.
You know, it's nice. It's nice to cut loose a little bit, but I need to be in control of that.
Yeah.
And a drinking game, the whole point of it is that it's out of your control now. You might have to do it. You're taking your little sips or something, but
you kind of got to really love like getting hammered, I feel, because like you say, it can just get way to the point where you're like on the floor.
Right.
Because the game.
I got over that phase of my life very quickly.
Yeah.
Right. And drinking games had a lot to do with that.
I just want to play True American.
True American.
The one from New Girl. Have you guys? I'm the only girl in the room.
You are.
Oh man, it has never been more evident.
I've seen the show New Girl, and I watch it a fair bit, but I just haven't seen that episode.
There is an episode. Well, there's a couple episodes where they play True American. It is a drinking game that they invented. It is. Let me see if I can remember the description. It's mostly Candyland, but also drinking, and the floor is lava. Ready, set, go! And you
How
yell
is that
out
a drinking game.
You yell, well, because there's the king is a bottle of whatever alcohol you'd like, and the pawns are all beers, and you have to use like pillows and whatever is in the room is squares to move to get the pawns to drink the beer.
I have a very important question.
And then you get confused. And
why is it called True American?
There's a lot of shouting president names.
Okay.
All right. What do drinking games have in common, though, besides this one?
Drinking.
Well, I think there's also an element of, like, screw your neighbor in a lot of drinking games. Yes. It's like, if I pull this card out, I can make someone drink or make a certain gender drink or age drink or something like that. So that's good fun.
Messing with the fact that your memory and reflexes are messed up. There's a lot of positive feedback loops in drinking games where the more intoxicated you get, the easier it is to get screwed and have to drink more, which feeds into why I hate drinking games.
It's that Schadenfreude, which is that German word for like taking pleasure in other people's kind of pain or unfortune. And so you see someone mess up and it's hilarious. Like, oh, you shouldn't have said it in that way. And
I think there's one other thing. They are almost zero thought.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
I think then, and
but
I think
still very mentally demanding for the state that you're
for
in.
The state you're in. Yeah. Right, yeah. But I think you can turn down the brain as far as strategy and competition.
Oh yeah.
And then you can just enjoy the activity that's happening.
Yeah.
And if you win, that's great. If you lose, that's still great.
Yeah.
Like, I lost. I have to drink. I won. You get to drink.
Yeah. I mean, if your goal is intoxication, you always win.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, if we're talking social games where you get to know someone and drinking games, the best one is always Never Have I Ever.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great – I'm going to make everyone reveal their secrets drinking game.
Yeah.
That can be dangerous.
But you really have to get everyone
involved.
It
can be dangerous.
Because the more drunk you get, the less you lie about what you've never done. Yeah. And that can become a problem.
Passive-aggressive couple fights.
Yeah. Yes.
In the middle of the game.
I'm sure many a couple has broken up over how I ever.
And before we get too far into drinking games and the result of it, we are about close to time.
Aww. It's time.
I know. Sad. Eventually it ends.
Oh. Well, that's good.
But we have a couple minutes, but I would like to say thanks, Spetzer, for being here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Yeah.
You're very welcome.
Yeah. Sydney does not, she's like, no, I'll email you. I don't want to be on the podcast. I'm like, okay, that's fine. I think Gloria might.
Oh, I think she will, yeah. Mm-hmm. She's got a narcissist streak. Yeah. She likes the sound of her own voice.
Hear myself?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Let's do it.
You're in your phone now.
Oh my god.
Or you will be. Let's see. We're recording on Monday night. Providing that the processing happens in a relatively reasonable time, 5 a.m. on Tuesdays,
ooh,
Central Time, or whenever the server time is. I'm actually not sure it's in my time zone.
All right. Let's be honest here. Do we have some like avid listeners who are waiting like, oh my god, it's 5:30.
It's gonna drop. It's gonna drop.
For the record, I am always looking out for it because I want to see when it drops. And no, we actually have a pretty decent listening crowd at this point.
Oh, wow.
Don't want to share numbers because, yep, you know,
it's embarrassing.
It really is.
I'm still in negotiation with the advertisers, so I'm just saying. Sure. But yeah, but no, it's good to have a good know when you're going to drop, though, because it forces us to say, oh, we have to record before this particular time.
That's true. You made a promise.
Yes.
Yeah. And you'd hate for people to think you're a liar.
It's a promise to yourself.
Yeah. That would be very out of character of you.
Go ahead behind the curtains and say, we normally record on Sundays, but I was too hungover.
Yeah. Yesterday was a rough day for us all.
It really was.
Yeah. So, on that note, Josh, why don't you take us out?
Indeed. Well, thanks for listening. And remember, we always want your feedback. So email us with comments and questions to tabletopgametalk@gmail.com. You can reach us directly on Twitter. I'm @Josh's Blonde. Chris is @GameMasterChris. And Kitty is @KittenL. Of course, you can always leave a post on our Facebook page, Google Plus group, or our BoardGameGeek.com pages. And as always, we'd like to thank Tristan Dunman for our cover art. She can be reached on Twitter @TristanDunman. Until next week, when we go in-depth on co-op games, keep playing games and having fun.
Good night.
Thanks for listening.